Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
This is a Manhattan-bound B Express train. The next stop is Grand Street.
Mind the gap.
Welcome to Skylines, the City Metric podcast. I'm John. A city I've spent quite a lot of time in is the very fine city of Miami in Florida. I love Miami to bits, partly just familiarity, partly, who wouldn't love a subtropical paradise, to be honest. But also, it's a very fine city to drive around, like some wonderful architecture. It's just a really nice drive down Ocean Drive and Collins Drive and so on. But we always end up going to the same two or three places. So on one of our more recent trips, decided to go and check out a different part of town, because we normally wander around South Beach, decided we'd go check out what's going on in North Beach. So we parked up, got out, and it was rubbish. Because all the stuff that had looked interesting from the car turns out to be quite a long way away from each other. It's not a good city for walking around. It's built on the scale designed for cars rather than the scale designed for people. I've been thinking about this because it kind of fits in with a loose theory I have that the best cities, the most interesting cities, are walkable cities, because you get a kind of density of incident. You can go, you can just find a nice little cafe and a nice little shop and a bar and so on. They're all sort of bumping up against each other. If a city's designed around the car, it's harder to achieve that. You know, in Britain, we've kind of got a fairly mixed record on this. Some cities are very good for walking, some rather less so. But this is our topic for today, and this is what our special guest is going to talk about. He's been sat there very patiently while I've taken a number of takes to get this far. So it's time to let him actually speak. Do you want to tell us who you are and why you're here?
Hello, I'm Steve Chambers. I'm Policy and Research Coordinator at Living Streets, the charity for everyday walking.
And you're here to talk about why walkability matters. Is walkability a word, first off?
Yeah, I think so.
If it isn't, it is now. We'll get it in the OED soon enough. So first off, obviously I care a great deal about cities being walkable because I'm the kind of idiot who spends his spare time walking aimlessly, poking at things. But, you know, why should this matter to normal people?
Okay, so cities that are walkable are more enjoyable to be in, to walk around, to discover. They're also healthier cities. By encouraging walking, by people getting people out of cars, you're reducing air pollution. They're physically healthier places. People are walking more, in particular young people, children walking to school. Governments are realizing that they're able to deal with a lot of the problems that we have at the moment, such as childhood obesity, by encouraging more children to walk to school.
Obviously, there are sort of health benefits. There are, it seems, potentially sort of cultural benefits too. And they're just, actually, that's a good question. Like, am I just making this up? The idea that like cities that are walkable are more interesting. Is there any actual research to back that up?
Not only are they more interesting, they are better economically. Look where we are right now in a basement in the City of London, all those banks in close proximity to each other, walkable to each other. The network effects of that proximity continues. Those banks still want to be located within walking distance of each other. So that kind of walkability not only has these sort of health benefits and environmental benefits, but also has an economic benefit. Businesses want to locate in these places where employees can walk to work.
I suppose that's kind of true in that, like, when the City of London finally sort of lost its monopoly on Britain's financial services industry, it's because another cluster popped up over in Canary Wharf where, again, it's a single private estate, right? People can sort of quietly nip off for a job interview or go to a meeting, whatever it may be. But at the other end, I suppose you've got like Silicon Valley, where like Silicon Valley is not, as far as I know, built around kind of human scale in that way, is it?
It's not. And what some of the tech companies have learned there is actually their employees don't want to be living in a car-oriented suburb. They want to be in San Francisco with its great walkability and access to services. And what we're seeing in London is the campuses out in Reading wanting to relocate, such as Google, into central London, because they know the kinds of people who they want to attract as employees want to be in walkable cities. They don't want to be in a suburban campus.
I've actually just finished reading a book by Richard Florida, the urban theorist who founded CityLab over in the United States. His new book's called The New Urban Crisis, and I was reading it to review it for the New Statesman. There's a lot of stuff in that about what he calls the creative class and how you attract them to a city. And walkability does seem to be one of the things. Just that it's very noticeable that the superstar cities he identifies, like London, New York, San Francisco, are all ones where you can sort of walk around rather than being reliant on the car the whole time.
And it's not just important for the creative class. Parents tell us at Living Streets that they want to walk their children to school, but it's basic things like safe walking route not being available, or the fact that there are just so many cars around the school actually make it unsafe. So improving walking sort of benefits everyone.
Okay, so let's talk about what you need to do to make a city walkable, because, you know, in principle, you can kind of walk everywhere, right? Like, it's actually surprisingly rare, certainly in Europe, maybe not so much in North America or the Middle East or something. It's surprisingly rare to come across a city that doesn't have pavements, but that's not enough, right?
Sure. So the quality of the walking route is important. We know that our perceptions of how long a walking journey will take changes when the quality of the walking route is lower. So people will actually think, oh, that journey to the shops, to work, to school will take me longer than it actually does. And we've got an idea that most people will be quite happy to walk for about 20 minutes. But if you perceive that you maybe have to cross a very busy road with a multi-stage crossing, so you're sort of held in the middle, maybe the quality of the pavements isn't very grey, isn't very wide, all these things, you'll actually perceive it as being longer. And you won't walk, and you'll get in the car. So just being able to walk it, just there being physically a pavement present, isn't necessarily enough. And one other thing I'd say on this, unfortunately, we are planning and delivering cities where, in particular on the outskirts of them, we have housing development without pavements. That's something that's happening.
You're kidding.
No, we are actually delivering that. And in some cases, okay, fine, walkability isn't possible because these have been planned very badly and they're not near services. They're not even connecting up to the nearest bus stop. So, yes, there are places where, you know, we're not putting in pavements, which is pretty rubbish considering that's, you know, current planning and current delivery of housing.
So you guys have talked about this concept of, you know, the need to create a walking network. What does that actually look like? What does that involve?
Okay, so this might include significant projects like a pedestrianisation. So we see that in London, so Oxford Street. We've been campaigning to have that pedestrianised, and it's in Sadiq Khan's manifesto, and he is now delivering that as a pedestrianised space. So it's creating those spaces and linking them up. There's another proposal at the moment to change or reallocate space on the route from New Oxford Street to Old Street that we are supporting. And again, that's about creating a network, linking up bits of good walking infrastructure so you can complete the entire journey on foot.
But, I mean, one of the questions that's always got to me around the idea of pedestrianising Oxford Street is there's an awful lot of buses on Oxford Street. And buses are also a pretty important part of London's transport network. How easy is it just to kind of pluck a major artery out of the network?
Well, TfL deserves some praise here. They've been quite clever. And what they've actually been doing, they've already started, is reallocating where the routes go along Oxford Street. So they're either curtailing them. So, in fact, if you want to go back to the history of why we have so many overlapping buses on Oxford Street, it's quite interesting. They were routes that went from one side of London to the other. And then as London got more congested, they split the route in two, but created an overlapping section on Oxford Street. So we have a lot of overlapping routes. So TfL have been cutting those back. So, for example, they'll end at Tottenham Court Road, corner of Oxford Street, or somewhere else. And they're able to maintain the same fares for those journeys because of the hopper ticket. What they've also been doing...
The hopper ticket is the ticket whereby you can now switch buses and not pay a second fare as long as it's within a certain time limit.
That's exactly right. So they're maintaining the fares and they're maintaining the journey opportunities. And what they're also doing is sending buses off in a completely different direction. So they were previously going along the street, they're now going somewhere else. So by the time, and they did, the last cut was about 40% of routes on Oxford Street, they have another change schedule. But by the time they actually close off Oxford Street, there won't be that many buses left. And one of the misconceptions around Oxford Street is this idea that all of these buses that we're used to seeing there, sort of clogging up the street, are just going to be relocated one block away. And that simply isn't the case. They've been working quite well to make sure that they are nearby, and that there's not too many of them on the adjacent streets.
Because that's the thing that I've always questioned, is there isn't really a sort of parallel route you can divert those buses to. I mean, there's kind of this Goodge Street, Mortimer Street, but that's a significant walk away in itself. And it's a much narrower road. You can't really just sort of pull all these buses down there, can you?
I mean, obviously there's the increased capacity of Crossrail / Elizabeth Line, which is coming in as well. So there is new transport capacity on Oxford Street itself.
So when are we likely to... We'll get back to the talking about this more generally in a minute, but when are we likely to see this coming in?
It is already scheduled to happen in 2018.
I didn't realise
the first stage.
Oh, I'm quite excited about
that. Yes.
We'll do a podcast special. We'll go for a walk. So as we do sometimes, as sometimes happens with this podcast, we got bogged down in the minutiae of London life. What examples are there you can talk about from outside Britain's capital?
Okay, so in England at the moment, we have new metro mayors, and we're very excited about them.
We're very excited. We're very sad about Sue Jeffery, but we're very excited about the other.
As campaigners, we always like someone's new door to knock on, and their biggest power is transport. So in the run-up to the elections, we saw some interesting commitments on walking. Andy Street promised to turbocharge walking in the West Midlands. Andy Burnham made some promises as well. One of the things we call for is to take walking seriously. And the way we think that happens is when someone in a very senior role is appointed with a responsibility for walking. And that happened in Greater Manchester with Chris Boardman, who's most famous as a cyclist, but he's also a keen walker. And that happened in the first 100 days of Andy Burnham being elected. We haven't seen that with any other cities, so we should hope to see those mayors catching up.
Now, when I was talking about some cities, interesting cities tending to be walking cities, one of the examples I was thinking of actually was Birmingham in the West Midlands, where, at risk of offending the people of that great metropolis, I do kind of feel that once you get out of the centre of Birmingham to the bit that isn't designed for, well, that is much more designed around cars, it becomes a pretty boring place to wander around. There's not that much to kind of bump into in a way that's not, for example, true of London or even Manchester to a certain extent. And it does just feel like Birmingham feels like a great example of why you shouldn't design the city around the car.
Yes, so we have seen some improvements in central Birmingham, but there is that feeling that you, and I've wandered around Birmingham myself, actually found it quite enjoyable, but you do sort of wander off a bit and you're like, oh, I appear to be on the slip road of a motorway. I'm not quite sure how that happened.
It's still quite clearly delineated when you're in the kind of nicely redeveloped city centre, and then you get out and you know you've left the city centre quite easily.
This is why these new metro mayors are quite good. They do have a remit over a whole region. So we would hope to see some of the work that they're doing not just focused on the city centre. And the way the governance of those mayors has been set up, they are scrutinised by the borough leaders, and there's quite a lot of power actually in the boroughs themselves. So hopefully we'll see those kinds of improvements happening, not just in the city centre, not just in the city proper, but in the outer boroughs of those regions.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50. Luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Actually, another part of the West Midlands that's been doing very interesting things on walking is, have you spent much time in Coventry recently?
I can't say that I have.
I went to Coventry for a series of articles I was writing late last year. And I was genuinely pleasantly surprised at quite how nice Coventry is becoming. Because it's very famously, it's a city that once, it was one of the great cities of medieval England. It had like this sort of very densely packed city centre and an old cathedral and so on. And the story's always been that it got ruined by the Luftwaffe. But that's not actually true. It was ruined by the council in the 30s that deliberately knocked down much of the old city centre to build great big roads for it.
And that's a story in a lot of cities. It's those mistakes of the post-war period that we're now have the opportunity to correct.
And to their credit, they're doing that in Coventry. One of the routes they've genuinely put a lot of effort into improving is the walking route from the station on the outskirts of the city centre into the central business district. They've put a lot of time and effort into landscaping this pedestrianised route, greenery, and you pass bars and restaurants and so on, so that your first impression coming into the place is, oh, this is much nicer than I was expecting. And they've had to take up a four-lane highway to do this.
Other things to make a city better for walking are actually pretty basic, the nuts and bolts of it. It is about reallocating space from the car to walking to cycling. Having infrastructure for cycling often improves the experience for walking. The investment makes both better. We also find that outside London, parking is permitted on the pavement. It's a situation where often walking routes are obstructed. And that's another thing that local authorities can get right very easily by restricting obstructions on the pavement.
I have a horrible feeling we're aggressively agreeing with each other, which doesn't make for a very interesting podcast. So I'm going to play devil's advocate now and say, surely if we take space away from roads, we're going to end up with a lot more congestion. People are not going to, people are always going to need to use their cars for some things. So aren't we just going to mean that they're going to be spending longer sat in traffic jams, or there's going to be less space for buses too? I mean, we need roads, right? What's wrong with roads?
We absolutely do need roads.
That's a boring answer.
But what we need to recognise is that the way we are using the streets is changing, and the space needs to be reallocated. And on the subject of congestion, for every journey that you mode shift from being in a car to being in a cycle walking, then you are reducing that congestion.
Just because it's purely a geometric thing, right? You're using less space if you're...
It's simply using less space.
This is something I've always found quite interesting about some of the more utopian ideas coming out of Silicon Valley at the moment. This idea that autonomous vehicles will mean we don't need the mass transit anymore is complete nonsense, because one of the main advantages of mass transit is it's a very efficient use of space compared to everyone having their own metal box.
Yeah. Every now and then I'll read an article with some tech person explaining how autonomous vehicles will allow someone to be picked up, and then another person will sort of work out a route, and they've basically reinvented the bus.
Yes. Silicon Valley is very, very slowly reinventing buses, isn't it? Anyway.
But the danger with autonomous vehicles is someone like me, who walks whenever possible, doesn't have a driving license, will start to get in a single occupancy vehicle. A lot of the benefits that they talk about with autonomous vehicles, about how it will be this amazingly efficient use of the space because they'll all be connected to each other. Well, to get those benefits, every vehicle has to be an autonomous vehicle. And I think that's a long way off. And do you want to be the government that says to people, oh, well, all of you guys who've still got these legacy vehicles, we're not going to allow them from next year, I'm sorry. So I think the idea of us getting to this stage where they're all autonomous vehicles and we're getting these benefits is a long way off.
We did a podcast on this some time ago with the Guardian's Alex Hearn talking about how there are actually different levels to autonomous vehicles and complete autonomy where there's no human involvement whatsoever is what's known as level 5, but we're much more likely to see stuff that's basically advanced cruise control much sooner than that.
The other thing that gets brought up with this is the idea, oh, there'll be electric vehicles and they'll be emission-free. And that simply isn't correct. Electric vehicles produce pollution when they are produced, the electricity that is used to drive them, and also their braking systems emit PM pollution, air pollution. So often we'll be told, oh, don't worry about air pollution. Autonomous and electric vehicles are coming, and that will fix it all. And that simply isn't the case.
Well, so aside from the pollution, getting back to the congestion point, they're still taking up space. There is still an argument that actually there are better ways to use scarce space in the city than giving everyone space for their own little metal box to travel around in.
Yeah, and potentially encouraging more people to take trips in vehicles. So we need to be encouraging people to walk and cycle where that's possible and use public transport.
So I'm going to shift gears a bit now and ask you, you say you're a pedestrian yourself. What's your favourite walk in London?
I guess I could say the river. Just every now and then I'll walk along the river on a Sunday and fall in love with London again, which is always a nice feeling. I don't know. I like the walk that I will do to work, even though it's down a pretty horrible, congested Holloway Road. I never cease to be bored of it. Well, actually, one thing I do is I use Google Maps to give me directions somewhere, and I place my headphones on, listen to some music, and then sort of stroll off. And every now and then it'll give me a voice cue to go back onto the path of where I'm ultimately going. But I'll use that as a way to sort of wander around the city, sort of slightly aimlessly, but vaguely with a purpose.
That's interesting, because something I, as I've said many times on this thing, I spend a lot of time aimlessly walking around London to the point where it's becoming increasingly difficult to find places I don't feel like I've been 100 times. And I'm always looking for new ways of just getting lost, basically. I'm wondering if I need to start doing silly things like finding a street that begins with A and one that ends with Z, and just like picking two random points and getting Google Maps to direct me between them. Something like that. Serendipity. So how do you get more? I'm weird. In terms of normal people, like, how do you get them to change the behaviour and show more enthusiasm for walking as opposed to getting on a bus for 3 stops, whatever it may be?
So we've talked a lot about sort of built environment interventions, how to make the city more walkable. But actually, a lot of the work that Living Streets does is about behaviour change. And we work a lot with schools to encourage children to walk to school. The government has a target of seeing 55% of primary school children walking to school. And what we find is that when we go into schools with children and encourage them to walk, we see an increase of walking rates of around 23%. So starting early, getting in when children are young, is a way to encourage walking.
So, I mean, that's not doing anything other than saying, hey guys, why don't you walk, basically, right?
So the way it works is we use a badge scheme where the children log on every day how they walk to school. And if they, by the end of the week, are walking to school, they'll win a badge, and the badges really incentivize them. They also get to design the badges themselves, have a competition, and it's incredibly effective, and it's very cheap as well.
This is what's known as gamification. If you introduce a slight competitive element to these things, you can kind of get people to do things more easily.
It is exactly that, yes.
What are the kind of, as we say, we've got these new metro mayors, like in some parts of the country, at least, there is now a focus in local government on the idea of place, which I think has been missing for decades now. What are the kind of things you want policymakers to do? What do you want these new metro mayors to be changing?
One thing is thinking about what the function of streets is. So we've kind of got this idea, oh, it's just something to ferry traffic from one place to another. And the reality is often these are indeed places. They are our high streets. The main purpose of some streets will be to shop, you know, a place for the economy to happen. And in those cases, then maybe there shouldn't be traffic there. or there should be less traffic there, or the priority should be for walking. So what we'd like to see is more thinking about literally what is the purpose of a street, each street. Is it actually a place? And having policy that reflects that.
I mean, there's often a lot of whinging from the car lobby in London. It tends to be the black cab drivers who object most vehemently to any proposals to... Although I do remember there was one of the biggest objections to the building of the cycle superhighway along the embankment came from a guy who was chief executive. I can't remember which bloody company he was, but someone did plot out his route between the airport and his office, and it went exactly down the embankment. And it's like, well, that might possibly be one of the reasons for his objection. He's just going to... Anyway.
I think there were some politicians in Westminster who had similar concerns about this particular cycle route.
It's just so blindingly obvious. But you know, there's always this kind of pushback. How do you win people over to the idea that actually... cities where it's easier to cycle or indeed walk is better for everyone.
Okay, so I can refer you to a book on this by Jeanette Sadiq Khan. I don't know if you've read it. It's called Street Fight.
I haven't.
Okay, so you have to use data, and you have to prove your point. You have to. So an example there was the shops in New York saying, "Oh my God, if we're pedestrianised here, we're going to have our takings down, our footfall be down." So they went in with counters before and after and counted the number of people going into the shops. With the cabbies, they were told, "We're going to have to take terrible long routes out of our way. This is going to impact on our income." They went in there with GPS devices and proved to them that this actually wasn't happening. So you have to demonstrate. And also the interesting thing that was done there, partly because of some nuance of New York planning, they could only do temporary schemes, which actually are really great for proving that it works. Mm. And also sort of gain buy-in. The other point about this fear of reallocating space is, once you've encouraged as many journeys as possible out of the car, in particular to walking and cycling, you've freed up the space for those, you know, let's call them essential journeys that need to happen in these vehicles.
So those sound like some very useful things we can do. Does taking the piss out of black cab drivers on the internet have any benefit?
No, I don't think that's useful. Although I would say over time, I think they've become more civil. So I think we've had a positive effect on them.
I'm surprised and reassured to find that evidence can actually change people's minds, because the impression I've been getting recently is that people get very dug into their sort of ideological positions to the extent where, like, presenting evidence doesn't actually change anyone's mind. It just kind of shows that you're the enemy.
I guess if you have a bit of evidence and it kind of backs up the story of what's happened, what you've seen, it can be convincing.
I suppose it's the difference between, like, evidence in the form of, like, statistics you can bandy around on the internet, and evidence in terms of lived experience. And, like, actually, if you can see that a physical change has had a positive effect on the city, that's kind of a different category of evidence, isn't it?
It is exactly that. It's linked up, isn't it? When you see sort of the evidence that's been drawn for different places, like, oh, that's somewhere else, or here's my caveat why I think this evidence doesn't apply to me. Whereas if you've got someone's experience of, for example, the street outside being pedestrianised and what happened that day, and then here's some data that sort of reflects it, I think that's more convincing.
That's a happy note to end on, that actually we can win this one. Normally these podcasts end with us talking about how we're all doing, so for once we're going to end with a smile on our faces.
Great.
There we go.